This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, Attorney General Martha Coakley on the steps of the Supreme Court urging the justices to uphold the state's law restricting protests around abortion clinics.
This is about keeping the public peace. It is about the appropriate balance.
But plaintiff Eleanor McCullen said the buffer loans law violates her right to peaceful free speech.
Here I am, gentle, loving, and I can tell you this, it's worth my time. Big time.
At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, dozens of university presidents gathered at the White House for a summit on college access and affordability.
We had made a commitment as a country to send more of our people to college. Michelle, me, maybe a few of you would not be here today.
And here in Boston, the MBTA will soon run trains later on weekends, but not during the week.
Quite candidly, we do not have the capability in the system to wind up being able to go 24/7.
So we'll dig into those stories and more from this week's news with our Week in Review panel. And joining us is Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinocchi. And hi, Joan. Good to have you back.
Hi, nice to be here.
Oh, wow, you sound great. The last time we had you, we had trouble with the line, so I'm almost startled by how clear you sound. It's, anyway, it's good to have you here. And with us in the studio, Pioneer Institute Executive Director Jim Sturgis. And hello, Jim, always a pleasure to have
it's
you,
good to be with you
as well. Let's begin with the Supreme Court challenge to the Massachusetts law that restricts protests around abortion clinics. The so-called buffer zone law requires abortion opponents to stand 35 feet back from clinic entrances. So here's Mark Renzi, a professor of law at Catholic University, who represents the plaintiffs who make the case at the Supreme, who made the case to the Supreme Court this week.
There's something seriously wrong with the sidewalks in Boston, Massachusetts, of all places, being closed to peaceful speech. The government's just not allowed to jail citizens for peaceful conversations on public sidewalks. They just can't.
Now, during oral arguments at the court, conservatives on the court questioned whether abortion protesters should be considered counselors rather than protesters. And the plaintiff in the case is a rather soft-spoken elderly woman who we heard in the introduction, Eleanor McCullen. Here's Marty Waltz, though, the CEO of Planned Parenthood in Massachusetts, talking about what it was like before the buffer zones were put into place.
There were large groups of people standing shoulder to shoulder in our doorway, usually screaming at full volume, not quiet counseling, trying to prevent our patients and staff from coming into the health center to come to work or to obtain health care.
So, Joan, I'll start with you. The justices from both the left and the right expressed some skepticism during oral arguments about the constitutionality of these buffer zones. What's your take on how they might rule on this case?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the plaintiffs have found an excellent standard bearer. It's a nice, quiet-spoken woman who doesn't look like she would create any big problems in front of this clinic or anywhere else. The predictions are that a more conservative court will not uphold this buffer zone law. Hmm. And I would say that you don't have to be conservative to sort of think that there are legitimate free speech and assembly, right to assemble issues here in this case. And personally, I mean, I believe in the constitutional right to an abortion. I believe in Roe v. Wade. But the buffer zone bothers me a little bit. Hmm. It is a public sidewalk. And I just wonder what other lines we're going to draw in other places to keep out speech we don't want to hear.
Of course, the broader context here, as Marty Waltz there was talking about, was that some of these protests did get sort of up in your face, and there's also been a violence of pretty a history of pretty serious violence in and around abortion clinics, including ones right here in Brookline. But I hear what you're saying, Joan. Jim, how about you? How do you see where this case is going, where it should go?
Well, I think the clip lays out the main issues in contention here. And again, it's the right to free speech, and it's also the right to access and mobility on the street and without undue harassment. I think there are a couple things that the court probably will look at, and that is, it seems from evidence provided by the pro-choice side that the six-foot bubble that was in place from 2000 probably wasn't sufficient. It was sort of a mobile bubble. Mm-hmm. They've gone to a 35-foot buffer. That's a giant buffer. You really, frankly, have to yell if you want to make your case. My guess is they'd probably look at what's a reasonable buffer. They've allowed for buffers in the past. And my guess is they will allow for a buffer in this case. I don't think they'll get rid of that.
Yeah.
The second thing is I think they will be looking at who has access to that buffer. Should it just be folks who are either agents or employees of the facility, or should it also allow for other folks? My guess, they may exclude everybody. I guess they have a couple of things to balance here. I don't think they'll get rid of the buffer wholesale. I don't think that the precedent actually points in that direction.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the things that the attorneys for the plaintiffs say, Joan, is right now protesters need to stand back. But, of course, clinic workers can come out and help people in. So, in a sense, they're allowed into the buffer. So the plaintiffs will say that's a sort of unfair application of the law.
Right. The plaintiffs are basically saying that the content of the speech matters and that we are saying that one message and one kind of speech has to be kept back 35 feet, where you essentially do have to yell, and that does make it more chaotic and more of what the Marty Waltz doesn't like and is complaining about here.
Joan, do you see do you agree with Jim? I mean, I wonder if the existing buffer zones are going to be replaced by something along the Colorado model, which is a sort of floating buffer zone, which
well,
the court upheld in 2000.
That's the question of the day, and I hate predictions about politics, sports, and Supreme Court decisions. But,
wait for later.
Wait for later. I'm going to ask you about the Patriots.
We'll
Colts.
See.
All right, we'll see. Let's move on. At the White House earlier this week, President Obama convened a summit with more than 80 college presidents to talk about ways to expand college accessibility, increase affordability. Presidents from Northeastern, Smith, Mount Holyoke, Amherst College, Bunker Hill Community were among those in attendance. And now, while affordability is a big problem for students at top schools, it's even more of a challenge for low-income students attending any college. The president laid out the problem yesterday this way.
Unfortunately, today, only 30% of low-income students enroll in college right after high school, and far worse, by their mid-20s, only 9% earn a bachelor's degree.
So, Jim, what about the problem of graduation rates? Colleges have resisted very strongly the idea that they should be evaluated based on their students' graduation rate. There are some really complicated issues here. What do we expect to come out of this summit, if anything?
I think just a little background before we get into this. About $150 billion in federal aid every year that is provided to students, undergraduates. About 60% of undergraduates tap into it. Tuitions and fees have risen at twice the rate of inflation over the last couple of decades, faster than household income. The average public university, public college costs now $25,000 to $30,000, and the average sort of private college is somewhere around $50,000. Mm-hmm. If you look at the president's plan back in August, which he released, he was talking about evaluating universities and putting in place, if you will, some sort of incentives for access to financial aid on the basis of some metrics. The problem with that is you could actually have great inflation in allowing people to actually pass through in order to make sure that you look good. There's all kinds of ways to game metrics unless you have a very clear set of metrics. And I think that would be very difficult to get to with just the variety of different universities. This specific summit seemed focused on something different to me. If you look at a couple of things they talked about, they're talking about how to make sure there's support for students who haven't, whose family has not sent a kid to college before, summer intensive remedial programs, community service programs. This was a little bit different. It was kind of trying to get back on the radar screen with this issue, which was brought up before, because the rating system, as you said, Anthony, mm-hmm. doesn't seem to be going anywhere. So I don't expect a lot to come out of this, to be honest. Mm.
What about you, Joan? I mean, Jim ticked through some of those statistics about the rising cost of colleges. We're talking about it year after year after year. It is a problem for middle-class families, for lots of families. Are we going to get anywhere on this issue? And does someone like this help?
Well, first, I would say, as the mother of a college junior, I feel the pain.
Our condolences, Joan.
I'm glad they're talking about it, and I think I agree with Jim's bottom line. I do not think much is going to come out of this. I think it's good that they're talking about it. It's not, and it's hard to disagree with any of the things that they're saying about the need to make college more affordable and to provide mentoring and all that, but I think that this is also about survival for colleges. I mean, there are so many middle-tier colleges right now that are enrollment is down. If people can't afford college, they're not going to be able to survive. So that's almost a market-driven need on their part to find some solution to this case of spiraling tuitions.
Hmm. Well, it's an interesting subject. We're going to actually take this up Monday on Radio Boston with a couple of college presidents. The presidents of Bunker Hill Community College and the president of Amherst College will both be here. So we'll go deeper into this conversation on Monday.
They may actually know the answer to the question.
Well, we'll certainly put it to them, and we'll see where we go from there. Let's move on to the MBTA. We had the general manager, Beverly Scott, join us on Monday to talk about the MBTA's new five-year plan. She made a case for the billions of dollars that the MBTA wants to spend in the next half decades. Here she is.
Let's think to ourselves and close our eyes and say, but if we do not have a top-notch, world-class system that permits us to be able for people to move and for commerce to move as well, what is it that we're giving as a legacy to ourselves?
So that's Beverly Scott, general manager of the MBTA. Joan, what did you see as the good, the bad, what was missing, what was not in the five-year plan for the T?
Well, Beverly Scott is a wonderful saleswoman for the MBTA, and I think they've put out a good plan. It's as she says, though, it's all about the willingness to invest in the T. Mm-hmm. Is there enough money over the years to afford what they've laid out? I mean, in the last year, when Governor Patrick put out a plan to fund improvements in the T, the legislature didn't come through with everything that he wanted. And then in the end, they ended up repealing the tech tax, which was going to bring in $160 million. So I'm not even sure how balanced the books are right now. Jim probably has more information on that end of it. But again, I mean, I agree with what she's saying. I think it's public transit is where we should be. Michael Dukakis said that decades ago. Whether or not we're going to invest in it is always the question.
Well, Jim, what about that? I mean, the MBTA wants to expand the so-called Indigo Line, the expansion of the Green Line. More trains are coming. There are already lots of complaints about the current service. One of our website commentators wrote this: the T can't even run the existing system. Why are we talking about expanding and putting more trains on the rails? Tough question there, but what's your view here of what's going on?
It is a tough question. I'll bet you that person actually rides the T. Look, the governor put on the table a $2 billion income tax increase. Anyone who looked at that generally said, well, it's general revenue. It won't go to transportation. The legislature and the governor worked together to put together a package that's about $600 to $800 million a year to invest in this. As Joan said a second ago, they pulled out the tech tax. You've got about $350 million maybe to about $650 million a year. All of that should go to maintenance in our view, and it's simply because, let me just give you a couple of factoids. The commuter rail system is the fastest growing commuter rail system in the country. Mm. It has lost ridership, 12.5% over a period of years. That's going in the wrong direction because of the cost, the pricing that they've put into place, because of the unreliability. And frankly, it's not like the subway system, which is actually growing in ridership. We need to address those things.
Address those things before we expand those things.
Absolutely. And if you want to think about expanding to Somerville and those things, the ridership is there. But expanding to places like New Bedford, where the ridership is absolutely not there to be sustainable, it's a huge problem. I mean, just one thing that every T rider will know. The T says that its on-time performance is 95%. Well, they decide that they will not include in the calculation those trains that are adversely impacted by weather, by a late train ahead, by a grade crossing accident. They won't include when there are speed restrictions that are called by the MBTA, when there's a slippery rail, when the MBTA directs someone to hold a train at a station.
In other words, they won't count all the reasons for which trains are delayed.
Right. And the fact is you're really down to probably something on the order of 50 to 70% of the trains on time. That's terrible performance.
Mm. Well, can I just add one thing?
Please,
on the
Joan.
Commuter rail plan, they just awarded a nearly $3 billion contract to a different company, a French company. So we'll see if they can do better than the former holder of that contract.
You wrote about this week, Joan. What's your view on Keolis taking over the commuter rail?
Well, again, I don't pretend to be an expert on the actual merits of the plan that they're proposing. I thought it was kind of a breath of fresh air that somebody from the outside was able to come in and bid and actually win when it was seen mostly as a done deal for the company that already had the contract. So we'll see if they can deliver on their promise. I think there are a lot more incentives built in to measure how successful they are, and to not let them get away with blaming weather and things like that for late trains, because we do have a lot of bad weather in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. in case anyone hasn't noticed.
Let's move on really quickly and just talk about climate change. Governor Deval Patrick announced a new $50 million grant program designed to help the state prepare for climate change, rising sea levels and the like. Here he is speaking earlier this week at the New England Aquarium.
What is the cost of inaction? We are trying to be thoughtful and not careless, but to think big and to act, if you will, commensurate with the challenge.
And I just want to play one more cut from this story. We spoke to Seth Kaplan, Vice President for Policy and Climate Advocacy at the Conservation Law Foundation on Tuesday, and he talked about the need for action on this issue in really urgent terms. Here's what he said.
The catalyzing event for so much of this was Superstorm Sandy. And, you know, what I've said about this is it's almost like we're in the foxhole, and the guy next to us got hit by a bullet, and that was New York. And only by sheer chance and timing, were those pictures of downtown Manhattan instead of the office buildings around Faneuil Hall.
So, Joan, climate change, rising sea levels, of course, big problems. Do you think that these local cities and towns even have the planning capacity to know what has to happen here?
Probably not. After Hurricane Sandy, it is hard to be glib and cynical about what could happen. And I guess overall it's a good thing. It is a good thing that the governor is focused attention and $52 million on it. Again, I don't want to sound cynical, but this kind of, it feels a little bit like this last year, a victory lap for Deval Patrick, where he's coming out and sort of shoring up his legacy on certain fronts, and climate change is something that he wants to address and talk about and say that he dealt with.
Mm. What's your view, Jim, on the challenge ahead and whether or not this plan from the governor is going to chip away at it?
Well, I was policy director for the state's environmental office for 3 years and participated in the regional greenhouse gas initiative working group with other states, and I believe that climate change is happening. I'm not an alarmist by any stretch. I actually think this is a very symbolic move. You've got 351 communities in Massachusetts, $40 million to give to them for photovoltaics, solar panels, stuff like that. Coastal zone management, if you're going to deal with some of the issues on our shore, $10 million will not do anything. I actually think it's a far better thing for our governor, with this governor or any other governor, to try and play a national role, cobble together alliances to do three things: address the power plants in the Midwest. We're not like that. We don't have a lot of greenhouse gases that we're producing. So we need to push for more fuel-efficient cars. And frankly, we have to move to try and get some sort of policy around energy-efficient buildings. We are a pretty responsible state, and I think sometimes we're kind of dumb about the way we approach things. For example, in Salem, they're trying to replace a coal-burning plant with a natural gas-burning plant. That's getting blocked. I think that's just unreasonable for the community and also for what we want to do in the future. I'd put the $10 million to the Department of Children and Families. We have known for years there are understaffing issues there. We have known since February of last year. There was a judge who put out a decision that said, look, no one's tracking these kids. The visits are intermittent. It's terrible service. This is a core service taking care of our kids. I would put $10 million there in a heartbeat.
Mm. All right. Well, let's move on now. We've got just enough time for our hubbubs, those little stories that didn't make the front page but are worthy of discussion nonetheless. Joan, what's your hubbub this week?
Mine's a little bit grim. It made news, not necessarily here because it was not a local story, but the execution of an Ohio inmate named Dennis McGuire put sort of new focus and attention on the death penalty and may generate more public debate and some lawsuits in the future. They couldn't get the drugs they usually used to get to put people to death, and the new mixture, with the new mixture, it took 20 horrible minutes for him to die. Lawyers are predicting it's going to rustle up a new round of federal lawsuits about the Ohio procedure. And there is a little bit of a local angle in that in Massachusetts, the Boston Bar Association, for the first time in history, took a stand against the federal death penalty, which will come into play with the upcoming Sarnaev trial.
Hmm. Jim Sturgis, your hubbub.
Well, let's stay on this grim theme. You know, there's a saying that says more flies are caught with honey than molasses. And I was walking by Langone Park and Commercial Street, and I learned that this is absolutely not true. January 15th marked the 95th anniversary of this headline in the Boston Post. Huge molasses tank explodes in North End, 11 dead, 50 hurt. A 2.3 million gallon tank collapsed. A wave of molasses 25 feet tall, moving at 35 miles per hour. It was waist-deep molasses for blocks around. There were some quotes like, horses are dying like so many flies on sticky fly paper. It just shows how absolutely this town has changed, but what you can find that just really surprises you as you walk around.
Interesting. Well, here's my hubbub. I want to just say a word or two more about the story that's been sort of brewing out there for the last week or two, the French government warning its citizens to stay out of Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury, obviously angering, justifiably in my view, people from those neighborhoods. Now, I'm going to give the Consul General, Fabien Fieschi, credit for going into the Codman Academy and talking to young people in there and telling them it should not be taken as offensive, not to you, because you are not responsible for everything that happens in your neighborhood. But I still think he and the French government missed the point that, as columnist Kevin Cullen pointed out, that places like Dorchester are a lot more complex with a collection of interesting and vibrant places. And, you know, if you look at the statistics of violence, invariably the people who are hurt in these neighborhoods where violence is at the highest is the residents. I would defy anyone to show me statistics where an outsider walking into Dorchester, Mattapan, or Roxbury is somehow set upon by raging groups of armed people. It's just not borne out by the facts. So, you know, I think my heart goes out to the people in those neighborhoods, and I, with respect, think the French have it wrong. So that's where I'm going to end this. Week in Review with Joan Vinocki, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you both so much and have great weekends.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Same here.
All right. And listeners, stay with us. Lots more ahead. We'll look at what happens to your digital life after you die. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.